Blog Talk Radio.
Probably brings to you Politically Direct, and I am the Professor Fernando Uribe. I want to welcome you all here tonight, the 19th of April, the 2018. Folks, again, hopefully we'll see some warmer weather throughout New Jersey in the coming days, and we're hoping it's here to stay. Again, I want to thank you all for listening from wherever you are here throughout the Garden State, and of course, throughout the good old U.S. of A. You can always write to the show's inbox, folks, which is Politically Direct NJ at yahoo.com. Once again, Politically Direct NJ at yahoo.com. And don't forget to follow the show on Instagram at Politically Direct NJ. You can also follow me directly on Instagram as well at @your_favorite_Fernando. Also, follow me on Twitter is greatly appreciated. And you can do so at Fernando Uribe Jr. And of course, for all you Facebook subscribers, of course, I ask you to please go to the official page for Politically Direct, like it, of course, and I ask you to tell your friends to do the same. 300-plus likes and counting, ladies and gentlemen. Again, I appreciate all the support online. I do want to hear from you tonight, and don't be shy. Call me toll-free, 818-572-8032. Again, 818-572-8032. Our toll-free number is brought to you by Insider NJ. Now, don't forget to check out Insider NJ, ladies and gentlemen, by going to www.insidernj.com for the best coverage of the political scene throughout the state of New Jersey. Once you go on the website, folks, just sign up for their morning intelligence briefing, absolutely free of charge. They'll get delivered conveniently to your inbox each and every morning. So whether you're having that nice waffle, maybe walking the dog, you're on your smartphone, maybe just having an omelet before you go to work and have to brave the traffic, regardless, check it out in your inbox, absolutely free. The best political news you can expect always from Insider NJ, courtesy of the Morning Intelligence Briefing. So again, go to www.insidernj.com for the best coverage of the political scene here in the Garden State. Don't forget to start your day with Insider NJ. Now, the opinions and views expressed tonight and every week here on Politically Direct are mine and mine alone. They do not represent those of Insider NJ, the management, the journalists, or the staff. Well, folks, again, hope you're having a wonderful April. Again, Tax Day was indeed yesterday, so hopefully you were able to file your federal and state income taxes on time, and hopefully you're getting something back from both Washington, D.C. and Trenton, respectively. So again, hopefully you are having a wonderful April, and I can only hope that warmer days are ahead, folks. Again, 818-572-8032, toll-free number you want to call in tonight. I want to hear from you. Definitely a lot to talk about here in New Jersey. We have a great guest coming up in just a few moments, so definitely want to stay tuned for that one. And, of course, let's get started with the first shot. Folks, you know, I was actually discussing this with my class today, and, you know, it's something funny about discussing sort of the liberties we have here in the United States, and one of our most sacred freedoms we have and liberties here in the U.S., I would say, that is – being able to practice the freedom of speech and being able to exercise that right freely and openly. And certainly when the founders back in 1787 at the signing of of our Constitution. You know, the founders were very specific about allowing the citizenry the freedom of expression, the freedom of speech, and that prevented you from suffering any consequences from the government, right? But what we're seeing now for some years, and especially with the increase in technology and certainly the dependency that we have on our smartphones and specifically social media, the way we look at freedom of speech has been challenged in recent years. And again, I'm not sure if you had a chance to take a look at this story. It was, I know it was featured on the National Newswire, and even here in New Jersey, there was a very unfortunate incident taking place with a college professor at a local community college here in New Jersey. And it was interesting to me because when I hear about these sort of situations, it's really demoralizing because let's be very honest about what we have come to expect and what we've come to know on our college campuses, folks, not just here in New Jersey, but throughout the country. And to be very fair, we've seen that there is a certain type of liberalism that's very pervasive on our college campuses. Certainly we're seeing, I mean, to some extent, I would argue, technical difficulties there. I don't know what's going on with my T-Mobile service. It just went dead. God, I hate T-Mobile. I swear to God. Jesus. Anyway, sorry. Again, 807 here, folks. I'm politically direct. I want to make sure that you certainly are still with us here on the program. And as I was alluding to in my opening monologue here on my first shot, it's really talking about the sort of the sad circumstances we're seeing on our college campuses throughout the United States. Again, here in New Jersey, we were again, I'm not sure if you saw this on the news feed, but it was astounding to me that a college professor here in New Jersey was actually sort of ridiculing and even belittling a student at one of the local community colleges. And it's amazing to me that this still goes on. But it really shouldn't shock us in the sense of this sort of a profanity laced tirade that took place. And it's, you know, it's really disappointing that this was, it took place. And again, for any of you that missed the story, certainly this community college professor is indeed under investigation for berating a conservative student in a tirade that was caught on camera. Now, again, Brookdale Community College sociology professor Howard Finkelstein allegedly slammed his hand on the desk and screamed the F word at a conservative student by the name of Christopher Lyle in a discussion about sexual harassment that another student captured on their Snapchat last week. He's constantly called me into his office and told me I can't speak in his class because of my beliefs, said the student. Now, Joey Smith, who captured the exchange on video, told a news outlet, specifically Fox News, he was recording the Sociology 105 lecture on his phone because he knew the professional professor was going to do something offensive or stupid. Now, the class at the time was discussing how women are victims of sexual harassment. When Lyle interjected that men can be victimized by women and offered a personal example, Finkelstein slammed the desk and shouted, F your life. And the two students accused Finkelstein of using his class period to single out and bash Lyle for his conservative views, telling a veteran in the class, quote, he's a murderer, and lecturing incessantly on white privilege. Now, folks, you know, and what's interesting, you know, the school's student conduct and compliance director, Christopher June, told Fox News this week that the incident contained many false and wholly inaccurate statements. The school wanted to say Brookdale Community College is fully cognizant of the First Amendment and the right it affords and does not discriminate against anyone based on his or her beliefs. It is in the best interest of all members of our community for the college to do its due diligence when a student or employee mentions anything having to do within the process of any investigation. And folks, whether it's, you know, this unfortunate incident taking place here in New Jersey, or even yesterday at Fresno State University in California, what we've been seeing pervasively is not even a rise, but we've seen sort of a consistent presence of radical leftist and liberal views on our college campuses. And I feel really bad for parents today that have to send their kids off to colleges and universities all throughout the country, knowing that we see this many amount of radical professors. And folks, let's be honest about this, because, you know, some people might want to beat the drum that there might be conservative professors on our college campuses, but they're very far and few between. And I can tell you because I know some of them, I've interacted with them. There are even some at my own community college where I teach at full time. And there are others that I know. Folks, I mean, I might not be completely conservative. I'm a self-identified libertarian. I might have some conservative views, but the one thing I don't do in my college classroom is espouse my beliefs or you know, project my opinions on students. So that's not my job. My job is to educate, not to indoctrinate. And what we're seeing consistently on our college campuses around this country, sort of blatant indoctrination of our college students by professors, whether tenured or non-tenured. And for example, yesterday's incident in Fresno State was just vile. Listen, regardless of your political affiliation, regardless of what party you're registered to, who you vote for, listen, Barbara Bush, okay, is, again, only the second woman to ever be the wife and the mother of two sitting United States presidents. So, you know, she was a classy lady. And again, regardless of your political affiliation, it's just about having some respect. And this English professor out of Fresno State took it upon herself to go on her Twitter and really tear into not just the deceased former First Lady, but to also tear into the Bush family, to ridicule both President George H.W. Bush and his son, President George W. Bush. And it was really, really unfortunate. And it was interesting to me because I remember, you know, reading about this on the air and sort of just outraged. And I remember I posted about this on my personal Facebook. I also posted about this on Twitter. And again, I'm very careful in what I post. I certainly didn't write anything inflammatory or derogatory, but I was very transparent in saying that this was a vile, disgusting act by, you know, a professor who very blatantly on her Twitter said, "Hey, I'm tenured. I make $100,000 a year. And, you know, nothing can be done to me." And I know subsequently the university president released a statement also on Twitter indicating that the professor, I believe her name was Rhonda Jarrar, J-A-R-R-A-R, had acted as a private citizen and not as an employee at the time in making these comments as an employee of Fresno State University. And folks, to be honest with you, she invoked Fresno State as soon as she could. And it's really disappointing and vile when we see that happening, whether it's here in New Jersey, whether it's in California or any college campus. There's no room for this sort of radicalism that's pervasive on our college campuses. And again, the First Amendment protects you against the government. It doesn't protect you from your employer. And again, I'm not trying to single anybody out, but you know, you got to be responsible with some of your social media content, especially depending on your profession. So you need to sort of, you know, for educators, for anyone, be careful what you post online. You have a right to your opinion, but your employer also has a right to not have you there anymore. So think about that, especially to all the radical liberal professors out there. Watch yourselves, because it's disappointing to see your behavior, not just here in New Jersey, but all throughout the country. All right, folks, again, and that is tonight's First Shot. Again, call us toll-free here tonight on the program, folks, 818-572-8032. Toll-free number brought to you by Insider NJ. And now, folks, at 15 minutes past 8 here on the East Coast, it's my pleasure to welcome to the program New Jersey State Assemblyman, the Honorable Michael Patrick Carroll. Mr. Assemblyman, how are you? Welcome to Politically Direct.
Well, it's going to take a lot more than an election or two to make me honorable, I'm afraid, Professor.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. That's awesome. Thank you. That's really, oh my God. That's really, really, that's great. Good to hear from you today, and thank you for being a guest. And folks, again, if you're just tuning in, certainly there's no stronger ally of the taxpayers here in New Jersey, specifically in Trenton, than the Assemblyman that's on with me tonight, Mr. Michael Patrick Carroll. Assemblyman, again, it's great to have you here. A lot to talk about in New Jersey. But first and foremost, you know, just doing my homework for this week and as I do for every single guest, you take a lot of pride in being New Jersey's most conservative legislator. I have to ask you, how much trouble has that gotten you into with your colleagues?
Well, none at all. I mean, it's someone's got to do the job. There are other people like Mike Dougherty out there who hold fair to that sort of title. Rick Merkt while he was in office and such along those lines. But I guess I've got it now by default. I've been around the longest.
Well, I have to say, again, I've looked at your voting record, and at the onset of my monologue, as I talked about, one of the things I take pride in as an educator is certainly not indoctrinating my students, but when I'm asked, when they say, hey, Professor Uribe or Dr. Uribe, you know, what do you lean? And I try to avoid those conversations, assemblymen, but if I'm ever sort of put in the corner or asked, I'm pretty transparent. I just say, listen, I'm, for the most part, a self-identified libertarian, but I tend to lean, you know, quite conservative on fiscal issues as a homeowner and taxpayer in New Jersey. I mean, we're taxed up the wazoo. I can be a little progressive on some social issues, but not many. But I take a lot of pride in just sort of being a traditional guy that believes in, I think, in good conservative values. And I know that, you know, doing my homework on you for this week, I can tell you that you're someone that I know Republicans in New Jersey look up to. I mean, that's at least my understanding. And when you hear that sort of description, or when you've heard the way you're depicted legislatively, you know, what's been your reaction, not just from fellow Republicans in New Jersey, because again, not everybody with the letter R is the same, just like everybody with the letter D isn't the same. What's been sort of the rapport you have with your fellow Republicans in Trenton? Because again, there might not be a unity, right, in the party?
Oh, never is. I mean, you know, when Nancy Pelosi herded all the Democrats together to vote for the Affordable Care Act, she got them all together. Republicans are like herding cats. It's just not possible to do. And conservatives don't take any orders from anybody. It was always kind of funny to me to read the Star Ledger talking about how we all quaked in fear at the prospect that Chris Christie might be annoyed at us. Never happened. I mean, you know, we don't take orders. We don't march with the crowd like the Democrats do. They're very disciplined. You got to give them credit, even in Trenton. They all stand together and march together. We never did that. We were always trying, even when we were in the majority, we were always trying to protect our weakest member, not trying to do really good things. And I think that was one of the problems that we had, because now we find ourselves on the outs, having done essentially nothing when we had the majority and could have done something.
Assemblyman, one of the things, and a name you just invoked right now, certainly elicits a lot of different reactions for people in New Jersey. And for me, and I'll sort of share a personal story and an opinion now, I'm willing to make the case, Assemblyman, that former Governor Christie really did, I would argue, some serious and irreparable damage to the Republican Party in New Jersey. And I'll tell you why. At least this is my opinion as a homeowner, taxpayer, and also as someone who ran for the state assembly in 2011 up here in Hudson County, which I know is a defeatist mentality. Don't remind me.
I wasn't going to say defeatist. I was going to say suicidal. But
Well, it is. Well, that too. But, you know, I wore it like a badge of honor, and I was really proud of the campaign that I ran back in 2011, where I raised very little money, but I did it just by fundraising. And, you know, my treasurer was my father. Like, that's how small my campaign was.
Are you kidding? My treasurer is me.
Okay, there you go. Okay, well, my treasurer was my dad, and we ran a very sort of low key, but a very sort of grassroots campaign. And I remember in 2011 that, you know, Governor Christie didn't really work as hard for Republicans in a lot of districts. And I know that here in Hudson County, running as a Republican is sort of a self, you know, as they say, a self-defeatist type of endeavor. But I did it anyway. I was asked to run. I felt privileged to run, and I did. And, you know, I was happy that I was able to garner a pretty good percentage as a Republican in New Jersey, in Hudson County, in the 33rd district. And, you know, years later, not to say that I've held a grudge against the governor, but I just know that during that time in 2011, you know, he didn't work as hard as I think as he should have. Or not just myself, but other,
you know,
but other Republicans.
Let me stop you there, Professor, because I mean, I think you're entitled to the view. It's not a uniform view, but you're not the only one who believes that. That said, the governor said, I think in 2011, when we first drew these districts with one of the Democrats, he said that he could get 60% of the vote and they wouldn't pick up a single seat in the assembly. And the guy laughed at him. Well, that's exactly what happens. And so when you hear the Democrats whine and moan and bellyache about gerrymandering around the rest of the country. It's curious they never they never whine or moan or bellyache about it here in New Jersey. They didn't draw these districts to lose them. And we have on occasion over the course of the last 18 years that I've been down there in the minority, Republicans statewide have actually sometimes won the popular vote overall on the state for legislature and still gotten minority. We're still in the minority. And I did a little piece a while back. You know, for example, you can get elected to the state Senate in District 21 with about one-third the votes it takes to get elected to the Senate in District 27. And I don't have to tell you which district is elected is represented by Democrats and which is elected by Republicans. We hold 7 of the 10 districts in which the most number of people actually turn out. The Democrats hold all 10 of the districts in which the fewest number of people turn out. And it's all because of gerrymandering and, not to put too fine a point on it, illegal aliens.
And we'll get to that because I know that that's a big topic with the current governor. And we'll get to into the dissection of Governor Murphy in just a moment. But just to sort of backtrack a little bit to that experience. And, you know, it was a worthwhile experience for me as someone meant to run, and I certainly enjoyed it. And, again, just speaking to other candidates throughout the state, I mean, it was unfortunate because I think that the perception has been put out there, and again, whether right or wrong, and you can clarify it for me because I know you're one of the most respected legislators in Trenton, that, you know.
Man, is that damning by faint praise.
I'm sorry, what was
that's
that?
That's a damning by faint praise.
it's hard to say that after 8 years that Governor Christie didn't really do any favors to the Republican Party. And,
I've known Chris for 20-some-odd years. Remember, I owe him my job because he was the very first guy I ever beat to win an office.
Okay.
So, you know, if it hadn't been for him losing to me, I might be governor today. One never knows.
That's true.
So, but I think much of what the popular perception is, I think first and foremost, when you look back at the history of New Jersey, I've been politically aware since probably the late 60s, and I think it's fair to say, without possibility of being really gainsaid, that Chris Christie is the best governor of my lifetime. He may not have done the Republican Party any particular favors overall, but I think that's more personal and media than it is political. I mean, really, after all, what could he have done? I mean, maybe you're right. Maybe he could have come out there and put a little more of his personal capital on the line to help get elected Republicans. I still think he wasn't probably going to do any good for you, but one never knows. We picked up 2 or 3 or 5 seats. So what? A minority is a minority. It doesn't get you anywhere.
No. Listen, I hear you, and I know that when in January of 2010, certainly he was battling a legislature that was going to be combative with him. Certainly, whether it was going to be the, you know, the subsequent Assembly Speaker Vincent Prieto at the time, and certainly state Senate President Steve Sweeney, obviously it was an uphill battle for the governor. And listen, don't get me wrong. I mean, aside from being a fellow Cowboys fan like him, there isn't much I see eye to eye with him on for the most part.
Well,
but
I'm not supposed to hang up at this point, am I?
No. but it's interesting. It's interesting the way you described it because you're not the only person to sort of convey that opinion, Assemblyman. And to me, again, you know, sort of wrap that up in the sense that it became sort of difficult, I think, for a lot of Republicans in New Jersey, especially, you know, going into, you know, after Hurricane Sandy and the leadership he showed there, which was overwhelming. I mean, listen, you know, regardless of what letter is next to your name, it was hard to not give Chris Christie credit for the leadership he showed during Sandy and afterwards, and then certainly going into 2013. I mean, he was riding a very high approval rating. He was able to get both Republicans and Democrats together on, you know, to support him. He had an overwhelming amount of Democrats crossing the aisle to support him, and now Barbara Bono, which was astounding because you figure, wow, okay, that's, you know, up here in Hudson County. I mean, State Senator Stack was having rallies for Governor Christie up here, you know. So it was amazing to me that he was able to sort of resonate across the aisle for his 8 years. Again, I mean, you know, we can certainly take 3 hours and not really dissect exactly what went wrong for the governor, but we can say
I've
that.
I've got the time. What are you doing?
I'm sorry?
I said I've got 3 hours. What are you doing?
Well, the interesting thing is, though, that and certainly we'll get to the effect that he had on last year's election in terms of how Lieutenant Governor Giordano was perceived, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But certainly, the former governor was a very unique figure. He was a very polarizing figure. What would you say was probably your best interaction with the governor during his 8 years, and of course, working in the legislature with him?
Well, again, one of the things you have to remember is that in my career in office, and I've been down there now for 23 years, aside from the time when Chris called me into his office because I didn't want to vote for his budget, and when he decided he wanted to appoint me to the bench, but the Bar Association didn't love me, so I'm still here, the only time I've ever heard from a governor at all, whether it was Christy Whitman or anybody else, was when Jim McGreevy called me on the phone about bear hunts. It's just one of the, when you're a backbencher, as it were, you're not the speaker and you're not in the majority, the governor doesn't really have much need or desire or what have you to deal with you. If you seek him out, he might be willing to help you. But we didn't really have much to do with one another, because it was the times when one of the few, the most impotent creatures in the history of mankind is a legislative minority. Our votes just are almost never relevant. The only thing we could ever do for him was to sustain a veto. And, so there was no one occasion I can point to and say, this particular interaction stands out in my mind. It's just not the way things roll down in Trenton.
All right, fair enough. And, as we transition away from the former governor into the current governor, I have to tell you something, and this is something that I've talked to people off the air and some operatives around the state that have reached out to me after they've heard the show and they've heard some of my opinions. I'm gravely concerned, and I'm not saying this to be malicious or to start a fight with anyone that I know in the governor's office, but as a homeowner and taxpayer or something, I'm concerned whether it's the recent legislation to provide financial aid to undocumented immigrants, which we'll get to, whether it's his desire emphatically to make New Jersey a sanctuary state, which that, I don't want to be California the East by any means at all, not whatsoever, or sort of the emphatic crusade he has about, legalizing marijuana, which I know that, you've also been a proponent of, in a sense. But, Phil Murphy really has been quite the contrast from what we know in the governor's mansion in the last 8 years. And certainly whether he's trying to appeal to a certain base here in the Garden State, I'm concerned, Assemblyman. Am I off base here? Am I overblowing this, or do I have a right to be very fearful?
If I said yes, we could solve it. We could make the conversation a lot easier. But no, I think you're accurate. You look at the tete-a-tete I had with the governor of Texas yesterday. The governor of Texas says, New Jersey businesses and people come down to Texas where we're a lot less expensive. We don't tax you nearly as much. And the governor's response is, we love to spend money on public schools, we're gay friendly, and we like Planned Parenthood. What's that got to do with the economy? Right now, just by way of an example, the governor comes from Massachusetts, all right? That's where he grew up. In Massachusetts, they have a flat income tax of 5.1% and a constitutional limitation on property taxes. They spend 12% less per year per kid to get a better education than we do here in New Jersey. And he's talking about spending more. Spending money has nothing to do, nothing, zero, zip, zilch, to do with the quality of an education a child receives. He appointed the chief of the most profligate school district in the whole state to be his education commissioner. So it's clear he honestly believes, truly honestly believes, that the way for New Jersey to prosper is to grossly increase the size of government, to massively increase taxes, and to spend a lot more money in ways that he thinks are fair. And if you as a taxpayer and a homeowner, whatever, get in the way, that comes under the heading of, oh, well.
And you know what? And that's disappointing, Assemblyman, because, when I hear some of the rhetoric coming out of the governor's office, and even going back to last summer when he was then candidate Murphy, and it was astounding to me. Number one, it was disappointing to see the voter turnout in terms of the amount of registered voters and the percentage of registered voters that came out to vote last November.
I was going to ask you, what voter turnout was that?
Well, I mean,
nobody came to the poll.
Yeah, it was a very low number. I think it was somewhere like in the 40 percentile, right? I think it was
like 39, I think.
Yeah, it was horrifying, and it was, as a matter of fact, I was just having this discussion today with my students as we were talking about voting rights, and we'll get to that in a little bit with you. I was just horrified about, again, sort of the apathy that existed in New Jersey. But, you know, the Star Ledger, which I don't really like to read too often, I don't really care for their editorial board. You know, they had a really interesting column last summer, I think, leading up to the election, where they said, hey, you know, one day New Jersey is going to have two really good people running for governor. It's just not going to be in 2017. I found that to be damning last year for the Star Ledger, which has an editorial board, which is as liberal as it comes for the most part, to say something like that. I thought was just, I thought it was embarrassing, Assemblyman. I thought it was embarrassing to us. I think it was embarrassing to our state. Am I wrong there?
Well, I don't think Phil Murphy's a bad person, and I certainly don't think Kim was a bad person. I think he was obviously the candidate that motivated his constituency. What I don't get is the belief, apparently in magic wands and unicorns, that we can tax, spend, borrow, regulate, and otherwise bloat the size of government our way to prosperity. If you look at New Jersey's budget and our circumstances, and you do not react in horror, you're not paying attention. You know, there's the old joke about that. If you can keep your head at a time when everybody else is losing theirs, perhaps you don't fully appreciate the magnitude of the situation. And that seems to me to be the problem with Murphy. He's talking, well, now we're going to have free babysitting or more free babysitting, free college, free this, free that. We're going to increase all these things. In the meantime, we're looking at a pension deficit, which is going to just be killing. It's astonishingly bad. Rick Merck and I, back in the 1990s, were urging that we go to defined contribution plans rather than defined benefit plans. And if we had done that, we wouldn't have the problem today. But if we've got this problem today, it behooves us not to go throwing hundreds of millions of dollars at other projects when we can't pay the bills we've already got. Let's take another situation. We've got Gateway. I think I happen to believe that the president is wrong on that. I think we should fund Gateway. But if the feds don't do it, we have to step up to the plate and do it ourselves. And that means we're going to have to take some hits. Some things that are nice, like free stuff for people who don't want to pay for things that they're getting, just simply can't happen. We don't have the money. And the failure to realize that, the going out in the stump and promising people stuff that any rational person knows can never be delivered, borders on dishonest.
Well, listen, you just hit it out of the ballpark or something, man, with everything you just say in your narrative. And folks, again, if you're just joining us right now, it's 8:33 here on the East Coast. It's my pleasure to have here on the program the Assemblyman out of the 25th Legislative District, Mr. Michael Patrick Carroll, a fellow Rutgers alumni. So it's happy to see that here on the program here also, a fellow Scarlet Knight here.
We should give a shout-out to Dean Chen, my classmate and now Dean of the Rutgers School of Law.
Oh, very nice. Well, I went to grad school in Newark. I mean, I did my undergrad in New Brunswick, but I'm proud of Rutgers graduate school graduate out of Newark as well. So certainly, some good things taking place there on that campus for sure with all the programs. Can I just call you Michael? Is that okay? Would you be like deeply offended if I did that?
Well, I prefer to be called like Your Eminence or Your Emperorship, but Michael will do.
That's great. Oh, this is awesome. Well, Michael, one of the things that you just say in your narrative, I mean, you hit it out of the ballpark completely with the idea that it's astounding to me, and I'm sure to you and to others, that, you know, the narrative about, you know, free community college and other freebies that are just sort of like code words to trigger turnout and to trigger a specific electoral base, it's just alarming to me. And it's alarming to me because I'm just amazed that, and you said it perfectly, where I've never heard of a situation where you can tax and spend your way out of a monstrous deficit like even the one we have here in New Jersey and just sort of like the fiscal environment and climate that we live in. And
it can't be done.
When I hear you say that, No, it can. And it's astounding to me that, you know, more legislators in Trenton, for whatever reason, either they're just walking into this blindfolded, they're either just oblivious, which I like to think that they're not, but hey, you never know. When you've heard the governor come out and say that, and you know, your colleagues, regardless of party, Michael, when you've talked to them, especially about the budget, I know when the budget being released, and certainly you have until June 30th under state law to pass it through both chambers, and the governor has to sign it into law. From what you've seen so far of the budget, Michael, what concerns you the most right now?
Well, we're going to spend even more than we spent last year. Let me give you, Chris, again, you were talking about Chris doing harm to the Republican Party, and the fact is that through his 8 years, he more or less kept a lid on the worst impulses of the Democratic Party. I mean, given their druthers, they would happily have taxed more, spent more, borrowed more, regulated more, increased the size of government, et cetera. But last year, for reasons that were not clear to most of us, he decided he was going to cut a deal with the Democrats whereby he would allow them to tack $350 million in additional spending onto the budget in return for some deal with Horizon. Okay, $350 million. That's a lot of dough. We didn't send a dime of it to the pension funds. We didn't spend a dime of it on Gateway. We didn't send a dime of it in tax relief. All of it went to new freebies, handouts, and giveaways. The governor this year is proposing about $2 billion more in more spending while not increasing the payments to the pensions, not doing anything for property tax relief, and not doing anything for Gateway or other projects like that. It just seems to me that what we have is a political polity, and I include the people here because Murphy was nothing if not honest with the people about what he intended to do, and they voted for him anyway. And what one must conclude is that the people are unwilling to make the kind of, or to cast the kind of votes and to elect the kind of candidates necessary to actually seriously govern. They want people to live in Wonderland where you can spend, and borrow and borrow and borrow and never have to pay it back. And I think, again, I don't know if any candidate would ever survive if he got out there and told the people the God's honest truth and said, hey, we're bankrupt, we're broke, we can't do all these things, and you're going to have to get by with less if you're taking money from the taxpayers. I don't know how it'd work. Certainly the public employees wouldn't like it, and maybe that person wouldn't win. But there's going to come a time, where if it's not voluntary, it'll be done involuntarily, when that's exactly what's going to have to happen.
Well, Michael, one of the things that stands out for me about, and you mentioned it right now, about Governor Murphy's sort of transparency when he ran, it was astounding to me. Like, he pretty much told you right from the onset that he was going to raise taxes. And, you know, you had to sort of, unless you're oblivious or you couldn't read between the lines, I mean, that's exactly the rhetoric that he conveyed last summer throughout the campaign. And it was quite scary to me that more and more people in New Jersey just weren't awake, or they just weren't, I think, more conscious about it. I just think whether it was just, again, I don't know if it was just Christie fatigue or they
were. Well, that's part of it. But let's be clear.
You know,
my father, God rest his soul, just died last year. He was a pollster, and he worked for the Quinnipiac poll. And if you, professor, right now want to write a poll, a question in a poll, that gets roughly 100% affirmative support, the poll will be, do you support raising taxes on people who make $100 a year more than you do to fund a program which will benefit you? Now, in a moral society, in a society with virtue, the people would say, no, we should not be taxing other people to pay my bills. I will pay my own bills. I will pay for the things I want myself. And yet you see repeatedly that if you go out there and you demand that we raise taxes on them, those other people, those people over there who are not you, everybody will vote for that. And that's what Murph did. He basically said, I'm going to raise taxes on those other people over there, those people behind the tree, not you, and therefore you should vote for me, and the people did. And as Ed Koch once said in his, one of his numerous prescient sagacious moments, the people have spoken, and now the people must suffer.
I know last summer he ran again on that, a lot of those campaign promises about, you know, again, those trigger words that people excited, especially, you know, within the Democratic Party about free stuff. I know he used on more than one occasion, the, you know, sort of the language of being someone that would oppose President Trump. And I know that that resonated throughout New Jersey. I know that back in 2016, during the presidential election, I know that his opponent, Hillary Clinton, beat him, I wouldn't say decisively, but I think the margin was more than 10 points in New Jersey in terms of winning the state during the presidential election. Do you think that maybe it was also a vote last November for Murphy in the sense of there were just people that, not Trump fatigue, but just were trying to make a statement about opposing the president, or they were just upset with the president? Do you think that has something to do with it, Michael?
Sure. I mean, voting's not always a rational thing. I mean, frankly speaking, it's funny. We conservatives, so you're a libertarian, you said, oh, so I'm going to give you the credit of going along with this. If someone says, do you support the president? Your response will probably be, on what? Because we don't go out there and support a man, or a person, rather. Our philosophy is we've got issues, and we'll say, well, I agree with the president on this, but I disagree with him on that. I disagreed with Chris Christie, for example, on legalizing marijuana. I believe it should be legal. So you say, do I support Chris Christie? I say, well, it depends. Tell me what issue you're talking about. Same thing with Governor Murphy. Do you oppose Governor Murphy? Well, no. When he talks about legalizing marijuana, I think he's right. So that I think there's a sense out there where people often vote irrationally, where they vote on emotions and such like that. And that's sad because then they can tend to get what they deserve. So if you're you out there voting against Chris Christie because you just because you thought Chris Christie was a bully, or you think that Donald Trump is an authoritarian, or well, that's a silly vote because you're not assessing the candidates based upon the merits. But does it happen? Of course it does.
Fair point. And folks here, again, if you're just joining us, it's 8:40 here on the East Coast, and it's my pleasure again to have Assemblyman Michael Patrick Carroll on the program here. Michael, you brought up an interesting point, and I had State Senator Ronald Rice on the show last week. We had a pretty extensive dialogue, and I know he's been one of the leading advocates in opposing the legalization of recreational marijuana. I know that you are on the opposite side of the political aisle in this issue, which is unique because, again, not many Republicans in New Jersey, I believe, side with you, correct, on this issue. And I have to sort of ask you, what's the thought process that's led you to, you know, have this position as it pertains to your New Jersey?
Well, as you know, as a libertarian, I believe that the government ought never to resort to the use of force except to prevent someone from harming somebody else. And if you choose to engage in smoking marijuana, the only person you're potentially going to harm is you. So basically, as between you and the government has no right or no legitimate power to step in and prevent you from doing that. So philosophically, we should leave people alone unless they're doing harm, and since this isn't harm, they should be left alone. As a practical matter, anytime you do you're considering a law, a rational individual says, okay, what are the benefits of the law and what are the costs of the law? Now, we know what the costs of the marijuana prohibition are. It provides a huge opportunity for organized crime. You look at the crime wave down in Mexico, a lot of which was caused by marijuana smuggling, with massive numbers of death, huge amounts of crime, et cetera, and so forth. Leave that aside for a minute. Let's just talk about the consequences to here in New Jersey. You have to hire cops to enforce it. You have to hire courts to enforce it and prosecutors to prosecute it, probation officers and parole officers, jail officials and prisons, and you have to go through a huge amount of time, effort, and expense to enforce this prohibition. Then you look at the consequences to the people who are snagged for simple possession, and they can't get, in some circumstances, they can't get college age, they can't get into schools, they can't get into the military. And you have to ask the question, this: all those costs being taken as a given, what are the benefits? And I'm hard-pressed to think of any.
Well, it's interesting you just sort of painted that scenario, and I've talked about this before on the air. I've had other guests on. I've had the executive director of SAM, the Smarter Purchase of Marijuana Organization. I also had the NJCIA on, the New Jersey Cannabis Industry Association on, and we've had some really, you know, lengthy programs here on the show in previous weeks discussing this issue. And I'll sort of add to your narrative that you just mentioned right now, and I've said this on the air quite previously, one of the things I take specific pride in is before entering academia, I worked in our criminal justice system for 10 years. After graduating from Rutgers in undergrad, I worked as a probation officer in the judiciary. I also worked as an investigator with the public defender's office in Essex County. And one of the things I saw, Michael, early on in my career was sort of just like the disproportionate amount of not just black people, but brown people that were adversely affected by our drug laws. And
that's
going
to happen anyway, because you got to remember that, because you were in the criminal justice system. If you choose to light up a marijuana cigarette in Harding, your chances of running afoul of the constabulary are small, because the police don't spend a lot of time worrying about people in Harding. If you do it somewhere in Newark, remember Ron Rice was a police officer, I believe, you're probably going to attract a lot more attention. And since black and brown people tend to hang around more in Newark than they do in Harding, you expect that sort of thing to happen. I'm not a big social justice warrior, and my philosophy has always been that if you don't want to run afoul of the constabulary, don't break the law. But if that is what it takes to get a good law passed, so be it. That's why I don't quite understand Senator Rice's views on the subject. I think he's perhaps looking at it from the perspective of the devastation that was wrought in some of his communities in Newark and other areas around there by other drugs, and perhaps considers this a gateway drug. I don't agree with him. So I will understand that. But it seems to me that if you want to prevent what the left likes to call mass incarceration, the simplest way is to make more things legal.
Well, you know what? And I'll add to that, too. I mean, just sort of going back to the narrative I was mentioning, you know, one of the things that I'm a very big proponent of, and I'm hoping that the legislature can finalize a bill that makes sense and that is going to, I think, be proactive in this, is really exploring decriminalization, Michael. I think that the time has come, especially it's just an opinion, but again, here in New Jersey, I think the movement for decriminalization, I think, is vital.
I must disagree with you. I think decriminalization is way too tame a remedy. To me, it has to be outright legalization, because decriminalization, you still have the police involved, and it's still something that is technically illegal, even if it's not criminal. To my way of thinking, the simplest solution to this problem is to simply get the government out of the business of regulating marijuana. We should treat it more or less along the same lines as we treat cucumbers or tomatoes.
Okay, I mean, that's interesting. And I'll sort of ask you as a legislator, do you think that the governor's motives or the agenda is he really concerned more about social justice, or is it just about another revenue source? Because it seems like, hey, you know, if it's another revenue source, you can tax it. Or do you think maybe it's a combination of the two? Like, what do you think the governor sits on that, if you had to make an educated guess, Michael?
He seems to me to be honestly a true believer in the social justice stuff. You know, to me, obviously, I'm obviously very skeptical of such things. But by the same token, you know, if you can combine his passionate belief in social justice with his passionate belief in taking a lot more money and putting it into government, if at the end of the day this is a tax which in effect comes out of the hands of people who are presently committing crimes because they're dealing in the black market, that's kind of a hard thing to argue against. If you're going to tax something, it might as well be criminals.
You know what? That's a fair point. And I'll sort of ask you this as well. And I think it bears mentioning. Again, this is just a guess on my part. I mean, you're in the legislature. You can certainly give me a much more educated, much more informed opinion on this. I don't see this happening in New Jersey this year, Michael. I think that there's still some serious, inner turmoil that exists within the Democratic Party, you know, in New Jersey on this issue, and I think even among Republicans. I don't doubt it.
I've discovered in my life that political prognostications taste a lot better going out than when you have to eat them later on. And so I don't like to make bets on such things. I just wanted to complete that thought by saying that if you saw the Monmouth poll today, 69% of registered Democrats and almost 50% of registered Republicans favor legalization or at least some liberalization of the marijuana laws. And what I've noticed is that when the people speak, the people that we elect to lead the people sometimes fall in behind the people.
previously you said that you opposed decriminalization. And the reason I brought it up, Michael, is because, again, you know, having worked in the CJ system for 10 years before getting into academia, it just seems to me that, you know, if you're able to do that and pursue, you know, responsible sort of expungement processes, that might be a good first step. That might seem to be a more realistic type of legislation that'll pass in New Jersey before outright legalization.
You and I are libertarians. Since when do we deal in realistic things? You know, it's
well, that's true. That's right.
You know, we're philosophers. You know, the whole idea is to get the best you possibly can. One of the things I think the lesson that Nancy Pelosi taught us is that you got to be bold, even if it risks an election. And I think from the perspective of the majority party here, the Democrats are not going to lose any seats in the legislature to Republicans in the fall based upon having voted for legalization of marijuana. So as a political matter, it's almost impossible for me to believe that any Democrat is going to run a risk for it. And there are lots of people, believe it or not, a lot of Republicans out there who I talk to fairly regularly, who are not quite single-issue voters but are very passionately convinced that this is one of the most important issues in their lives, and they want to make sure it's legalized.
Wow. That's interesting. Another issue I know that the governor has been very adamant about, and one that really strikes a nerve for me, Michael, and I talked about this on my local podcast here in Hudson County last night, and I know that last week the Assembly had passed the bill. I think it was a waiting signature for the governor. You can correct me on any of the facts as I'm trying to recall the story, as it pertains to providing financial aid for undocumented immigrants. And I know that the governor has been very adamant about being a champion or an advocate for illegal immigrants in New Jersey. And one of the things that sort of doesn't sit well with me, and I was just having a discussion with one of my colleagues who's very, very liberal, and she was chastising me. And I said, listen, I'm the son of immigrants. You know, my mom left communist Cuba, tyranny and oppression, at the age, before she was even 20, I believe. And my father left Colombia for a better economy here in the United States. And they came here legally. They did it the right way. They worked hard, tried to give me a good life. They did. Taught me to make good choices, to follow the rules. And it's something that, you know, it's those life lessons that I retained from my parents. And, you know, as someone who's paying back his loans from grad school, and, you know, when I hear this language from the governor, Michael, I mean, again, and excuse my language, it really pisses me off when I hear this sort of the idea of, wait a minute, why aren't we helping citizens in New Jersey? Why aren't we helping people here in New Jersey that are struggling to pay back their own college loans? Why are we so eager? And again, listen, I said this to my colleague, this doesn't make me a racist. This doesn't make me a bigot. It makes me a concerned taxpayer. And I don't know, again, and I know that identity politics has become so pervasive in our political climate for far too long, but it just, when I hear that sort of language from the governor, and I hear many in the legislature that are being so sympathetic to a particular, not electorate, but a particular base in New Jersey, it really just upsets me. Like, why isn't there this emphasis on helping taxpayers and citizens? Why isn't there an emphasis on helping people like myself who are paying back our loans? Help us first before you want to spend $2 million to set up an office of immigrant protection, for example, or you're trying to create financial aid for illegals. I mean, I don't know about you, Michael, and I'm pretty certain I know where you stand on this, but this pisses me off to no end. How do you feel?
Well, first and foremost is you run a huge moral hazard. I mean, you remember Ronald Reagan in 1986 agreed with the Democrats, and we had a broad-based amnesty for then-existing illegal aliens, and the argument was, okay, now we're going to enforce the borders this much and no more. How'd that work out? All it did was encourage more people to come. When the rumors spread around Central America that Barack Obama was going to let anybody in, the gates were flooded with people that came in. It's a huge moral hazard. I think we have to be tough. We have to be very clear to people. You can't come here without permission. If you set foot in the country and you're here without permission, you will be sent home with no ifs, ands, or buts. You will go home. And when New Jersey takes a stand that, hey, we're going to be welcoming in such a long lines to people who are here illegally, it's an open invitation to lots more. That said, I think we can go even broader than that, is that we as libertarians and the people who understand how government works and how people act know that there's no such thing as free stuff anywhere. Someone always has to pay. You said you're a professor. I'm assuming for the moment you don't do it for free. You expect to be paid for your efforts. And,
absolutely.
And that's quite reasonable because you're imparting knowledge to the next generation, which is great. That said, not one person in your class should be there for free. If you are an adult and you're 18 and you want something and you can't afford it, if you're not going to borrow money, I have a four-letter solution to your problem, ROTC. Show us that you're willing to give something back. Two of my sons are soldiers. They got GI benefits as a result of that. If you're not willing to serve the country, then we don't really need you. Go pay for it yourself. If you're willing to fight for the values that this country stands for, then we should be willing to help you out with a college education. But there ought to be, every time an adult wants something, there should be a price attached to it, because there always is. And it's folly to pretend that anything is ever free.
No, listen, you're absolutely right. And by the way, my biggest and dearest appreciation to your two sons. I thank them for their service, and I hope they're staying safe out there. Are they still in active duty, or have they completed?
Well, actually, they're both guardsmen, and I will say this, that after Hurricane Sandy, one of my sons was deployed to a very rough area in Hoboken.
Oh, well, yeah, you know what? Well, it can be. Listen, don't kid yourself. There's some mean streets there. Don't kid yourself.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of my sons did some time. Another one is looking at a deployment overseas. It's something that has to be done. And I think one of the biggest mistakes that we have made as a country is to allow people, a substantial number of our people out there, to believe that anything is ever free. And you know, even in places like Sweden, for example, they have conscription. You know, you have to be willing to step up to the plate and to give back directly and personally when something is given to you. Now, most of the people that we're talking about here, the illegals we're talking about here, are the so-called dreamers. I know you've met these people, and many of them are every bit as American as you are or I am. The only thing is they're the beneficiaries of a crime committed by their parents. And again, the problem with that is giving them a benefit is opening up the door to lots more benefits to people who will do it again in the future and say, hey, you did it once before, and you know how the SJWs are going to act. They're going to say, oh, yeah, hell, let's give it to them too. No. If you want to stay and you're a dreamer, one of the first things they should insist upon is you do the same things like sons are doing. Be willing to defend your country. If you show me that you're willing to defend your country, welcome. You can stay. If you're not willing to do that, why do we need you?
You know what? That's well said. And it's interesting to me that, you know, after, you know, the recent developments, and again, and I talked about this on my local show here in Hudson County, obviously, you know, being that it's the most densely populated county in the state, and certainly there's a very, very heavy immigrant population here. I talked about this on my local show, and, you know, I'm not sure if you had heard your fellow Assemblyman Jay Weber talk about and I even talked about this on the show, about an inconvenient truth that he shared with the press shortly after the news broke last week. And he went on to say, and you know, I want to hear your thoughts on this quote from Assemblyman Weber. He says, quote, "The bill doesn't make sense from a fiscal perspective, and it doesn't make sense from a fairness perspective. This bill obviously takes away financial aid that would be available to citizens of the United States and give it to people who are not citizens. Whether they're not citizens through their own fault or somebody else's fault, they're not citizens. Most people in New Jersey, most people in this country think that and expect that citizenship means something. And unfortunately, and increasingly, it seems to be that's not the case." Did you have a chance to speak with Assemblyman Weber on this? I know before I went to a vote, and certainly it went along party lines to no one's surprise. Did you talk to Assemblyman Weber?
Not specifically about it, but he's right in that there's despite Phil Murphy and the Democrats' apparent belief to the contrary, we do not have a money tree, let alone a tree of a farm of money trees that we can harvest $100 bills off of. This program, the TAG grant program that they're talking about here, for example, specifically limited. it's going to reduce the payments to other people. And to the extent that we choose to aid our citizens, we should aid our citizens. I mean, we're not handing out money to people from Pennsylvania. It's limited to people from New Jersey and people who are legal in New Jersey, citizens of New Jersey. And that's the way it should be. Again, that should not be controversial because – and again, I want to come back to it again because – If Ronald Reagan hadn't made the mistake in 1986, see now that as a Republican admitting that Ronald Reagan made a mistake, some people should try that at times, admit their own party can make a mistake, we wouldn't have this problem because the Dreamers shouldn't exist. Their parents should have been sent home immediately. And so we find ourselves because previous administrations, and it wasn't just Obama, by the way, it was the Clinton administration, the Bush administration also did much the same thing. They just simply ignored the laws they didn't like. And that should not be permitted. I think you can disagree with the immigration policy, but you got to agree, at least in theory, you got to agree that if the law exists, it has to be enforced. And I think that that's where Donald Trump is coming up big. He's saying, look, if you want to change the law, feel free, but I'm going to enforce the one we've got. And that's the way it ought to be.
Well, you know, Michael, it's interesting you just said that because what I find fascinating, and I, conveyed this talking point to colleagues of mine. I say, listen, if you ideologically want to disagree with the president's immigration enforcement policy, that's one thing. But you do realize that in the last 8 years, Barack Obama deported more people in his 8 years. And again, you can correct me if I'm wrong, Michael, than almost what you saw during the Clinton years and Bush 43 years. That's an astounding amount of people. And you never hear the outrage. You never hear the backlash of it. And when I convey that talking point, it's like hearing crickets, Michael. And it annoys me to no end with my colleagues, especially my liberal ones, where they say, yeah, but Trump is – no, listen, let's be fair. Again, and I'm not working for the Department of Homeland Security. I don't work for ICE. I'm not privy to that classified sort of those documents. But I have to believe that the president, the 45th president, is invoking nothing different than what the 44th president did in terms of enforcing immigration law. Now, again, whether the media is being intellectually honest and reporting on it, they're not. Because let's go back to the stats that Barack Obama deported more people in 8 years than his two predecessors. And it never gets the flack. It never gets the flack that it should. And it always boggles my mind when I hear the selective memory of people or the selective, usage of facts when it comes to that, Michael.
Could be, my thought is if Obama was actually enforcing the law, that was certainly one of the few good things you could actually say about him.
That's true. Yes, that's true. And speaking about, again, sort of the philosophy that Governor Murphy has and sort of the vision he has in New Jersey, certainly he's been a very big advocate for illegal immigrants. He's not been shy about that. Another position that the governor's taken, Michael, and certainly one I think that maybe you can shed some light on, is the fact that, the governor has not been apprehensive at all about tightening gun laws in New Jersey. And I know that in recent months and years, we've seen, gun violence resonate through the Associated Press and the news cycle, and certainly we hear there's a lot of hysteria. Certainly after every mass shooting in the country, we start hearing the cries for gun control and stricter gun laws. And I know that Governor Murphy apparently is really catering to the gun control crowd here. Have you voiced any concerns to the governor's office or to your colleagues in the legislature about how potentially problematic this can be to like law-abiding gun owners in New Jersey?
Well, I spoke. It's any law that would this goes back to the marijuana laws for a minute. For example, if you've got a situation where you're creating hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of felons for no good reason, that's a problem. I mean, one of the things that you mentioned, mass shootings. Again, I was 60 years old last week, and when I grew up, we didn't worry about mass shootings. When my kids were growing up, they didn't worry about mass shootings. What's changed? I mean, what is it about this particular generation that makes some small number of them want to kill each other? And it's not just guns. I mean, there was a case not long ago where a guy walked into a school and knifed 21 of his classmates. And admittedly, that instrumentality is less lethal than a firearm, but the underlying mentality that going into a school and trying to kill people, what is it about this generation? What have we done to create some small number of people who feel that way? Now, specifically respecting the laws here in New Jersey, not one of them would have any effect upon the kind of events we saw down in Parkland. Not one. And so
that's right.
When you push
that's
through
right,
a whole
yeah.
bunch of bills, which are totally and completely divorced from the facts on the grounds, one has to question your motivation.
Well, listen, that's a very good point. And I would sort of piggyback on that and say that it really lends itself to studying societal trends and what's been going on. Again, I'll be 43 next month, and you know, growing up here my entire life, I'm also baffled, Michael, by the fact that, you know, when I grew up in elementary school and high school and going even into college at Rutgers in New Brunswick, I never felt the sense that this would be such a pervasive problem for me, you know, or at least how I would look at it through the lens of a citizen or just a person in general about whether or not schools would be safe or being out in a public arena or in a mall would be safe. It's astounding to me how pervasive of a problem it's become in the last 20 years. I would argue probably since Columbine, right? I mean, I would say that was back in 99.
Well, that seems to be it. And one of the interesting things you find out about this, the New York Times ran a story a while back about the concept called contagion, in which what you find is that virtually all the mass shooters and the killers study Columbine and previous other mass shootings. They get the details down. They study it. They want their names in the paper. They want to be famous. And you know, perhaps that's the problem, is we have created a situation where we make such celebrities out of vicious criminals that they breed copycats. And I guess that's always been the case. I mean, Charlie Manson was well known. Bonnie and Clyde were well known. And now we've got these. Everybody knows the name of Dylan Klebold. You know why? Because he was a nutcase who shot up his school. And perhaps it's almost impossible to find a remedy for that, because what you really want to do is, if there's a so-called mass shooting, mass shootings, shut up about it. Don't give the guy his publicity. Don't use his name. Don't talk about it. That would possibly work. I don't know how you could possibly do anything about that, but it's clear. I mean, guns aren't any more prevalent than they were when we were kids. Certainly they're much more difficult to get these days. People are much more paranoid about them these days, and yet we see more of these high-profile undertakings. And as a result, what the Democrats have done in Trenton is to adopt all sorts of bills which have absolutely nothing to do with the actual events. They just use it as an excuse.
Well, you know what, and when you mention that, now it sort of lends itself to a much bigger question in the fact that, you know, how invasive, and again, I know you're a staunch conservative, and you know, in terms of what you've published, and certainly as an advocate in the legislature, I mean, how invasive is this becoming, though, in terms of a mindset for the Democratic Party? Michael, not just in New Jersey, but you think nationally, do you think it's something that we're heading down that road? Because it seems to just, you know, for a party that seems to want to stand up for the little people, it seems that it's almost suffocating the little people, don't you think? Or
well, with this sort of thing, again, the only thing it does is harass law-abiding gun owners. I mean, for example, we passed a bill that's going to limit the magazine size to 10 rounds. Okay, and the argument is that, well, what about the person shot with the 11th round? Maybe we'll save a life. Well, first of all, the shooter down in Florida used 10-round mags, so that pretty much puts that to rest. And second thing is, if you're going to measure the size of a magazine by the number of dead children you're willing to tolerate, the only morally acceptable answer is zero. And when I brought that point up on a television show I did with one of my Democratic colleagues, her response was, I'm down with that. You know, their philosophy was, we should ban the civilian ownership of firearms. You know, and the argument that American people can't be trusted with firearms, but that cops and soldiers can be, is really profoundly at odds with what Americans have believed for hundreds and hundreds of years.
You know, that's right. And it's astounding to me that there's such an outcry now about, you know, wanting to modify the Second Amendment. And it seems that, you know, we're seeing advocates from all demographics and certain ideologies that they're more than willing to use their First Amendment rights to infringe upon the Second, Michael. And I don't know, it's worrisome. It's worrisome because when we see that sort of behavior, listen, let's be very honest too, and I don't want to sort of sound slanderous in saying this either, but the media, the liberal media doesn't do us any favors either, whether it's here in New Jersey or nationally, Michael. And that, I think that's also problematic, I think, in this discussion, whether it's about gun rights or gun violence or gun responsible gun ownership or taxation. It just seems that whether it's here in New Jersey or even nationally, that the media has just become pervasively irresponsible over time. And that, again, as an academic, it just concerns me because I just don't think we can put the genie back in the bottle about ever asking for responsible journalism.
Well, I got to quasi-disagree with you on the grounds that there's never been a such thing as responsible journalism. It's like the good old days of politics when people debated issues. That's never been the case. People like me love the idea of logically and dispassionately discussing an argument and making fact-based arguments and coming to a conclusion based upon logic and fact and reason and cost-benefit analysis. That's not how it works. It just doesn't happen that way. And if you've studied the press, you know that there's never been a time when the press was responsible. They've always been irresponsible schmucks. They got us into the Spanish-American War in 1898 by turning what seems to have been an accident with the Maine into an act of war by the Spanish. The press back in the days of Thomas Jefferson and John Adams was terrible. And so there's never been a good old time with the press. They've always been just as bad as they are today.
I mean, I'll even make the case here. I mean, specifically here in New Jersey, which is where we live. I've just seen it so often, and I saw it a lot through my undergraduate years and during grad school and even now. It's disappointing. It really is. But at the same time, to your point, like, I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised either. If you do your homework on this, it's something that has been quite evident for decades, right? I mean, actually hundreds of years, going back to what you just mentioned, though.
Mm-hmm.
Michael, one of the things I also wanted to cover with you this evening, because I know that you've been a staunch and very vocal, I wouldn't say, listen, I mean, you have not been dismissive of it, but I know you don't agree with it. Why this sort of insistence by so many, whether it's in academia, whether we see it in the legislature, in the media, about this insistence on social justice? And is it just a camouflage for not trying to address issues much more rationally or academically, or as you mentioned, logically? Or is it just the fact that some people just need to invoke emotion into discussing topics and issues?
Justice is one of those words like unique. It's really difficult to modify. So justice, you can't have social justice or economic justice or racial justice. Justice simply is an individualized concept. It means that you will treat every individual fairly in accordance with his or her individual merits, accomplishments, or what have you. Throwing groupthink into it is where you get to the so-called social justice aspects of it, where you have to somehow try to treat a group correctly. For example, we did this bill down in Trenton a while back where we are now going to insist on sort of equal pay by gender or by sex by statistic, where we're saying it doesn't matter that no individual is discriminated against if, as a group, women are paid less, oh, by the way, they're not, than men. That will constitute a problem. And the idea is underlying it is somehow groups are being treated unfairly. Well, that's just not true. And when you have an entire philosophy which is based upon groupthink, that's where you arrive at these problematic policies which attempt to judge by group rather than by individual.
Well, what you just mentioned right now, I'm sure on more than one occasion, Michael, has probably garnered you some serious backlash, right? I mean, based on based on what you just espoused, I mean, I'm sure that you've been called a sexist. I'm sure you've been called a racist, right? Because whether it's Yeah, and in the sense, you know, obviously you've learned to develop a thick skin. What's been the best argument for you, though, in terms of disproving those accusations? Because, listen, in this climate that we live in when it comes to identity politics, it's so easy to throw the race card out there because it's done so often. And to be honest with you, I think it's become exhausting. I know for me, and again, I'm someone, and I've talked about this in my class when we talked about race relations in one of the sections I teach. I've always made it a point to tell my students, like, listen, I'm not trying this opinion here. My job isn't to indoctrinate you. I want to have a rational, logical discussion here today about the material. But at the end of the day, I've always made it a point. I'm like, identity politics has become so ingrained in our culture, our political culture, Michael. And it's alarming because, you know, I'd like to think that it has an expiration date, that at some point, okay, it's going to wear off. It's a fad. It's a trend. It's going to just evaporate and disappear at some point, hopefully, because common sense prevails or, you know, rational discussion prevails. And I'll be honest with you, it almost sickens me because I have this argument all the time with my colleagues. I'm like, everything isn't about identity politics. It's not just about throwing the race card out there. Like, that's exhausting. And for you, I'm sure, for example, you know, when you talk about obviously, you know, when you've talked about that there is no inequity when it comes to pay based on gender. I agree with you. I've looked at the data. I've looked at statistics and research about this. When you hear some of the negative connotations that have been attached to you for these opinions, what's been the best way for you to disprove it?
Yeah, well, first of all, if you accept their premise, you've already lost the debate. Is that the general rule is, I've forgotten what the name of the guy was, he says the first guy to bring up Adolf Hitler in a debate loses. Well, the first person to use the word racism loses. And you just ignore it because the fact of the matter, it's ceased to be a word that has any meaning. I mean, there was a story today in the Star Ledger about a Muslim woman whose tire was allegedly slashed, and they said there was a racist note put next to it. Muslimism or Islam is not a race. If you look out there in society, when was the last time you? It happens now and again, I suppose. But racism is phenomenally rare, and to argue that it isn't is just basically a matter of religious fervor. The idea that somehow the society is massively racist—it's nonsense. And you know, but it's something you have to believe to be in identity politics. You have to believe that the wage gap exists, even though it doesn't. You have to believe that this is a racist society, even if it isn't. You have to believe that there are all sorts of people out there just seething with hatred at various and sundry so-called marginalized groups, and that just doesn't happen. So when you realize that the people are speaking from an ideological perspective and that the words they're using really don't mean anything, that solves the problem, because if you try to prove you're not a racist, that's a debate you're going to lose. I mean, the headline is Carroll claims he's not a racist. Again, you don't win that debate, so there's no point. You just ignore it. As you should, because the as a general rule, the allegation is almost inevitably silly.
Well said, Michael. Folks, here it's 9:20 here on the East Coast, and joining me here exclusively on Politically Direct is the Honorable Assemblyman from the 25th Legislative District here in New Jersey, Michael Patrick Carroll. Just a couple more minutes here of his time. And I wanted to get your feedback on this, Michael, because I know last week when I had State Senator Rice on, we had a pretty good back and forth about voting and voter ID laws. And I sort of threw, not a wrench at him, but I threw an opinion at him that, and we had a very healthy back and forth. And I said, Senator, you know, one of the things that I grew up believing in was the sanctity and legitimacy of voting and to making sure that it's fair and trustworthy and not fraudulent. And I said to the Senator, I said, you know, the right to vote is one that's been bestowed to us by our founders in our founding document. It is one that comes under considerable scrutiny oftentimes as it pertains to discussing voter ID laws. And I said, while the right to vote, while voting is a right, and I know that there are other privileges or luxuries that we have where we utilize an ID. If I wish to exercise my Second Amendment, I need to present an ID to purchase a firearm. Obviously, it's a lot more difficult now in New Jersey, but that's another point. If I wish to own a bank account and go to a bank, it's not a right, it's a privilege. I have to present an ID when opening an account if I wish to fly in an airplane, which I'm not a fan of, but I'll do it if necessary. Certainly, it's not a right, it's a privilege. I have to present an ID. And a plethora of other activities that IDs are necessary for to verify your identity. And I said to the senator, and I said, I understand the talking points that have existed in the past or some of the arguments that have been presented, but if we're truly interested in making the process of voting an accurate one, and that the process is trustworthy, and mind you, the idea of obtaining a valid state-issue ID in New Jersey costs you $24. If you don't operate a motor vehicle, but you want to go to the DMV and just get an ID, you present the necessary documentation, and it's $24. Now, again, I don't want to insult anyone who's poor here listening tonight or in New Jersey. Maybe $24 seems like a lot of money to some people, but it doesn't seem to me. And if that's what it takes to get an ID, and if we want to ensure the legitimacy of the process, what is wrong with requiring an ID when you go vote? Like, how is that racist? I don't see it as racist. Am I missing something? And when I posed that scenario to State Senator Rice, he came back, he was trying to throw some historical points at me about sort of the disadvantages that people of color have faced, previously and hundreds of years ago. But in present day, I said, well, Senator, but at the end of the day, it's like, don't you want the process to be fair? Don't you want the process to be accurate? Like, what is remotely racist or discriminatory about asking for an ID when you go vote? I mean, I get it. Nothing. It's a right. You don't want to infringe on it. But, if you want to go, again, if you want to go buy whatever, or you want to make a major purchase, if you want to buy a home or what, again, it's a privilege. It's not a right. But what is racist or what is discriminatory or prejudicial about verifying that you are who you are? I don't get it, Michael. I mean, could you explain it to me? Or am I not explaining the narrative correctly?
I think by asking the question, you've answered it. But I will say this. The one aspect of the argument that someone might make is that the incidences of in-person voter fraud are probably very rare. So the emphasis that the left likes to put on voter identification laws is weird, because overwhelmingly, like 90-some-odd percent of the people in this – probably almost 100% of the people who are registered voters or would be registered voters have some form of ID, which would be sufficient. It's just huge. I mean, it's not easy. It's not hard to get. But I think the much more complex issue, or the much more relevant issue, is the ability of people to commit fraud with absentee ballots. And that's something that voter identification laws won't necessarily solve. Interestingly enough, we just did a bill, which I think the governor signed yesterday, on automatic voter registration. And I would have voted for that bill if it didn't have a get-out-of-jail-free card for voter fraud. It specifically says in the bill that if you are registered by a motor vehicle agent, and you're not supposed to be, it will be presumed that they did it accidentally, and therefore you won't be guilty of voter fraud. Now, why would you put that in a bill? Unless you were afraid that people were going to be invalidly registered and then would go vote. And obviously, let's put it this way. For the 200 years the 250 years this country has existed and had votes, whenever there's been fraud, it's always hanging around in cities. And right now those cities are run by Democrats. So obviously, whether it was Mayor Daley, Chicago, whether it was Jersey City, whether it was even today, there have been allegations of voter fraud, mostly in Democratic primaries, interestingly enough. We have to be careful because down in Pennsylvania, you saw, or in Virginia, was it? One vote made a difference in the entire balance of a legislative body. They had to actually flip a coin. So if you had one fraudulent vote, just one fraudulent vote cast, that was relevant. And we've got to be sure that no fraudulent votes are cast. And that's not difficult to do. Reasonable security measures should be taken.
Well said, Michael. Well said. And before I let you go, I know you've been a gentleman being on the air with me for over an hour. I appreciate it. I'm sure it's
if you ever accuse me of being a gentleman again, I'll never come on with you.
Okay, fair enough. Maybe a question you might get every so often, and certainly because how exhausting the position can be and certainly what you have to endure in Trenton. How much longer do you want to keep doing this in the legislature?
I'm not going to run again. I'm tentatively right now. I'm looking to run for surrogate here in Morris County in 2 years or 2019. It's the kind of work I do professionally, so it'd be a perfect lateral move for me. But I will admit it does get wearing, especially when you've been down in Trenton and been in the minority for almost two decades. It's very difficult to get anything done. Your vote isn't necessary for the most part, and there comes a time when you just get tired of banging your head against the wall. There are lots of people in Morris County, lots of good Republicans, lots of good conservatives, and my inclination is to let one of them take a shot at it in 2019.
Now, Michael, I have to ask, I'm not sure if you've discussed this openly anywhere else. Is this an exclusive you're sharing with me today, or have you also made
the papers. I've been interested in the surrogate's job for a long time because it's the kind of work I do. It's the kind of work I'm very interested in doing. And it's a good way for me to serve without having to go down to Trenton and beat my head against the wall. I could actually do some good up here, and so that's probably what I'm going to do. Unless of course I hit the lottery next week, in which case all bets are off.
There you go. Okay, fair enough. Before I let you go, Michael, and again, you've been great on the show today, and I really appreciate your candor and your transparency. And listen, I'll be very, very forthright with you. I really enjoyed speaking with you. There's a lot ideologically that I see eye to eye with you on. And again, I applaud you as a very dignified and a very transparent member of the legislature. I know that as a New Jersey resident, I'm happy to have you in Trenton. I know that, unfortunately, I don't live in Morris County. I wish you were my representative, but I don't have that option. You know, I live here in Upton County, but I certainly
you're
going to
let a little
thing
like a district line stand between you and good government?
I certainly want to thank you for how transparent you've been with me this evening and certainly having a great discussion about a variety of topics. Before I let you go, this is something I do every week with all my guests. I've spent the last better part of an hour not necessarily grilling you but asking you questions. Now, you know, I'll give you the floor, Michael, and now is your turn to, if you want to grill me or ask me a question, hey, the floor is yours now, Counselor.
As a Cuban expat, what do you think of the choice down in Cuba for a new leader today?
You know, it's disappointing. Nothing's going to change policy-wise. Nothing's going to change in terms of governance. I don't foresee that the new president will be willing to have any sort of diplomatic amicability with our State Department. It's disappointing. And to me, Michael, listen, it's one of those things where, you know, my grandmother turns 100, God willing, now in June. And I know that when she left Cuba, along with my grandfather and my mom and my aunt, respectively, in the late 60s, you know, they left with nothing but a suitcase. And, you know, the reality of that they've never been able to go back and visit because they don't want to, you know, in their minds, and rightfully so, you know, when you go visit Cuba, all you're doing is pretty much, you know, spending money and contributing to the pockets of the government, not to benefit the people. I mean, we're seeing antiquated cars still being driven around and, you know, there's an absence of civil liberty and civil rights. Well, yeah, well, I mean, the reality is if you're a tourist, I mean, hey, yeah, it's great. You can party like a king, but when you live in the country there, it's oppressive and it's disappointing that someone like my grandmother will never, you know, never get to see her homeland again and other Cubans that I know. So it's disappointing. You know, I very much like to see the government there be a little more amicable to opening up relations with us, to then be receptive to free elections, to the implementation of more civil liberties. But it seems like a pipe dream right now, Michael. It really does. It's disappointing. I hope that changes. I don't know what's going to happen now. You know, one less Castro in power is great. But it seems that it will just be business as usual down in Havana, as they say.
Well, I'm just let's hope that this guy is a Gorbachev in disguise and that we'll get some perestroika out of Cuba and 3 or 4 years from now, the ramparts will fall.
I hope so. And again, you know, Michael, I want to thank you for coming out tonight. You've been I know you want to hear this again. You've been an absolute gentleman. You've been a gentleman and a scholar. And of course, you're a fellow Rutgers alumni, so why should I expect anything less, you know? And
I'm sure that
Dean
Chen will be happy for the plug.
There you go. I do want to thank you tonight, Michael, for coming on. And really, I hope you've enjoyed our conversation tonight. And I appreciate you supporting Politically Direct and Insider NJ. And I hope to maybe sometime over the summer after the budget passes or close to passage, we'll see what's happened, what's been omitted, what's been inserted. I'd love to have you back on the show sometime over the summer, so I'll definitely coordinate with you, and it'd be great to have you back on Politically Direct, sir.
I appreciate your time there, sir, and thanks very much, Professor, for having me.
Have a great one, and if I, again, have a great Memorial Day. Keep up the great work in Trenton.
Yes, sir.
All right, have a good one. Folks there, again, it's 9:30 here on the East Coast. It's my pleasure, again, tonight to have the distinguished assemblyman from the 25th Legislative District, the great Michael Patrick Carroll, on the program here. A great show tonight, definitely. It's great to have him on, and certainly one of the true conservative voices in New Jersey politics that is not afraid to stand up for what he believes. And certainly, you know, one of the things here on the show, folks, that I take a lot of pride in on Politically Direct is having guests, whether they're elected officials, advocates, those that are community, you know, organizers, and everything in between, to come on the program here and to have a dialogue. And that's what we need here. That's what we bring you on Politically Direct each and every week. And it's one of the things that makes the show distinct and makes it unique. And again, I can't say enough about the strength of our guests that we have here on the program, going back to January, whether it is, you know, advocates from the Working Families Party and Ana Lilia Mejia, for example, to State Senator Ronald Rice last week, to now Assemblyman Michael Carroll. Again, what we have here, folks, and I think what we do better on this show than anybody else in the state is to give you a very diverse set of guests and a very diverse set of discussions about topics that affect us as taxpayers, as residents, as citizens. And that's what you can expect, folks, and that's what you can continue to expect here on Politically Direct, here on Insider NJ, and also on Blog Talk Radio. So again, it was a great conversation this evening, and certainly some a few good laughs tonight with the assemblyman. So I appreciate his candor and his humor tonight. He was definitely a stand-up guy here tonight, talking about a lot of things I think that are important when it comes to New Jersey politics, and certainly the way that we, you know, approach not just the perception in Trenton of Governor Murphy, but also certainly the perception of what happened with Governor Christie in the previous 8 years. So definitely a really, really good episode today with Assemblyman Michael Carroll, again, out of Morris County in the 25th Legislative District. So, you know, again, it's when you can have good guests like the Assemblyman folks, it makes my job a hell of a lot easier. I'll tell you that much for sure. So it's definitely one that I'm enjoying here on Blog Talk Radio, specifically in my partnership with Insider NJ. Now, folks, again, if you missed any part of tonight's broadcast, don't forget you can always go to www.blogtalkradio.com/politicallydirectNJ. You can listen to it from any PC, Mac, smartphone, or tablet. Definitely a great conversation tonight with the Assemblyman out of the 25th Legislative District. Again, Mr. Michael Patrick Carroll. Certainly, you can listen to last week's episode with New Jersey State Senator Ronald Rice out of Essex County, and all the other wonderful guests that I've had throughout the many weeks here on the show. Again, even going back a few weeks ago with former Governor Jim McGreevy, and very interesting conversation with the former governor. Again, if you can always check it out at www.blogtalkradio.com/politicallydirectNJ. And folks, again, I just sort of want to give a shout out here to my mom celebrating her birthday this past Tuesday. Also a shout out to Edible Arrangements, folks. And if you've ever had the desire to send that special gift to someone, folks, check out ediblearrangements.com. They're great. Their delivery is professional. Their presentation is outstanding, and their baskets are just amazing. You know, I'm glad that my mom and dad got to enjoy all the fresh fruit that was on there. So, again, happy birthday to my mom, again, from Tuesday. I'm not going to reveal her age out of respect to her, because I know I'm kind of private about my age as well. So happy birthday, Mom, this past Tuesday there. And again, a shout out to Edible Arrangements for the great job that they do with the gifts that they provide and that they make available. And very affordable too, folks. If you're looking for that really special gift right now, as you know, it's springtime, we're going to have graduation soon, proms, weddings, communions, confirmations, bar mitzvahs, whatever, hey, Edible Arrangements, that's Lee, the way to go. So definitely check him out. And folks, again, you know, it's just want to sort of send a shout out here to the Graham family and specifically Pete Onelia at Insider NJ for their continued support of this show, for their belief in my abilities. I'm immensely grateful to them because, you know, like anything else, when you decide to do a show like this and to go on live each and every week and to talk about issues that matter to New Jersey residents. And listen, I've had I've had exceptional guests since I started this program back in January. And it's one that, you know, it's, you know, and now as we're approaching May soon, in just about a little over a week and a half, I've been blessed with wonderful guests and I've been blessed with a wonderful view, you know, listenership and audience. And again, I appreciate all the likes on the social media pages for Politically Direct. I appreciate the traffic online in terms of people listening live and also on the replays and listening to the archives. Again, I can't say enough about how deeply thankful I am to all of you for contributing to the success of Politically Direct. And, you know, we'll keep it going. We're going strong here. We're going to keep getting you great guests each and every week. And coming up, folks, again, just as a reminder, a good personal friend of mine, Mr. Matt Rooney, attorney extraordinaire and the editor-in-chief of Save Jersey, which is quite arguably the preeminent conservative blog in New Jersey, the preeminent conservative website and blog here in the Garden State, talking conservative politics, and certainly a lot of wonderful contributors on the website. Again, it starts with Matt Rooney, the editor-in-chief, and certainly other friends of mine on the website, my dear friend Katie Sarola, some great content by her on the website. Also Joshua Einstein, you know, who also contributes to Save Jersey. So definitely want to check him out. And so again, I'll have Matt Rooney on, the editor-in-chief of Save Jersey, on next week on the 26th of April. And then coming up on May 3rd, I'll have Joe Caruso, the chairman for the Organization for Economic Growth. They're a very interesting nonprofit organization here in New Jersey, advocating for sound fiscal policies in the Garden State. So some great guests coming up in the next couple of weeks, ladies and gentlemen. You definitely don't want to miss out. And as I said to you before, if you missed any part of tonight's exclusive with New Jersey State Assemblyman Michael Carroll, you can go to www.blogtalkradio.com/politicallydirectNJ. Don't forget, if you have any questions or feedback, if you want to let me know what you think of the show, don't be hesitant. Write to me. Again, politicallydirectnj@yahoo.com. I answer each and every email. I make sure to get back to people right away. I want to hear from you folks about what you like about the show, what you don't like about the show. That's the only way that this program will grow, with your support, with your feedback, with your encouragement, with your guidance. That's how it grows, and it starts with you folks. So again, write to the show, politicallydirectnj@yahoo.com. And don't forget to follow the show on Instagram @politicallydirectnj. You can also follow me directly on Instagram @your_favorite_Fernando. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter @FernandoUribeJr. You can also make sure you like Politically Direct on Facebook. Again, 300 plus likes and counting, folks. So I'm very grateful and ecstatic for the encouragement on social media for the pages. So definitely keep them coming. Share them. Feel free to tag me anytime. And again, I appreciate the support that you have for Politically Direct. And don't forget to check out Insider NJ, ladies and gentlemen, by going to www.insidernj.com for the best coverage of the political scene throughout the state of New Jersey. Again, just go on the website, click right at the top. You can register and subscribe absolutely free of charge to the Morning Intelligence Briefing that gets delivered conveniently to your inbox each and every morning. All the juicy stories, all the latest coming out of Trenton, the Golden Dome, the Governor's Mansion, and all 21 counties in New Jersey, folks. So you know what? It's free of charge. It gets delivered to your inbox. You can read it while you're having a waffle in the morning, while you're walking your dog and you're on your smartphone, maybe while you're working out on the treadmill at home. You want to just do some reading. Hey, you won't be disappointed because it's always excellent content on the Morning Intelligence Briefing. Of course, starting off with the editor-in-chief, Max Pizarro, a great friend of the show, and certainly all the wonderful columnists and journalists that work with Insider NJ. I'm proud to work with them, and I'm proud to be a part of the team, and certainly you won't be disappointed. So, again, always don't forget to start your day with Insider NJ. All right, folks, again, it's coming out to that time of the show, and what can I say? It was a great experience tonight, and we'll continue bringing you great guests here. And don't forget that whether it's on your morning commute, you're getting a daily workout in, hopefully the weather's getting warmer and you can ride more often, maybe in the backyard, maybe do a little tanning, maybe you're out your front porch having a cigar or a glass of wine, hey, walking your dog, doing laundry for my students, both past and present, hey, you know, as I know you're studying for finals coming up, take a break, tune in, and you'll be happy that you did. And never forget, it's real, it's here, it's politically direct. Good night, Morristown. All right, big shout out to all my friends out there in Motown, up there in Morris County. I'll see you next week, folks, on Blog Talk Radio. And don't forget, let's keep on talking.